eyes. Night had fallen. He was shivering. A woman knelt beside him, and he felt her hands gripping his shoulders. She was shaking him, speaking to him. "Sir, are you all right? Can you hear me? Sir, can you look at me and tell me what's wrong?"
"He's drunk," a man's voice.
"No, Harold, he's sick." Ethan tried to pull her face into focus, but it was dark and blurry, and all he could see were those street lamps shining like minor suns across the road and the occasional streak of light from a passing car.
"My head hurts," he said in a voice that sounded far too weak and pained and fear-filled to be his. "I need help."
She took his hand and told him not to worry, not to be afraid, that help was already on the way. And though the hand holding his clearly didn't belong to a young woman, the skin too taut and thin like old paper, there was something so familiar in the voice that it broke his heart. Chapter 4. They took the Bainbridge Island ferry out of Seattle and headed north up the peninsula toward Port Angeles, a convoy of four cars carrying 15 of the Burke's closest friends. Teresa had been hoping for a pretty day, but it was cold, gray rain. The Olympics obscured, and nothing visible beyond their narrow corridor of highway. But none of that mattered. They were going regardless of the weather, and if no one else wanted to join her, she and Ben would hike up alone. Her friend Darla drove, Teresa in the back seat, holding her 7-year-old son's hand and staring out the rain-beaded glass as the rainforest streaked past in a blur of dark green. A few miles west of town on Highway 112, they reached the trailhead to Striped Peak. It was still overcast, but the rain had stopped. They started out in silence, hiking along the water, no sound but the impact of their footfalls squishing in the mud and the white noise of the breakers. Teresa glanced down into a cove as the trail passed above it, the water not as blue as she remembered, blaming the cloud cover for muting the color, no failing of her memory. The group passed the World War II bunkers and climbed through groves of fern and then into forest. Moss everywhere, the trees still dripping, lushness even in early winter. They neared the top. The entire time, no one had spoken. Teresa could feel a burning in her legs and the tears coming. It started to rain as they reached the summit. Nothing heavy, just a few wild drops blowing sideways in the wind. Teresa walked out into the meadow. She was crying now. On a clear day, the view would have been for miles, with the sea 1,000 feet below. Today, the peak was socked in. She crumpled down in the wet grass, put her head between her knees, and cried. There was the pattering of drizzle on the hood of her poncho and nothing else. Ben sat down beside her, and she put her arm around him, said, "You did good hiking, buddy. How you feeling?"
"All right, I guess. Is this it?"
"Yeah, this is it. You could see a lot farther if it wasn't for the fog."
"What do we do now?"
She wiped her eyes, took a deep, trembling breath.
"Now, I'm going to say some things about your dad. Maybe some other people will too. Do I have to?"
"Only if you want to."
"I don't want to."
"That's fine."
"It doesn't mean I don't still love him. I know that. Would he want me to talk about him?"
"Not if it made you feel uncomfortable." Teresa shut her eyes, took a moment to gather herself. She struggled onto her feet. Her friends were milling around in the ferns, blowing into their hands for warmth. It was raw up on the summit, a strong gale pushing the ferns in green waves and the air cold enough to turn their breath to steam. She called her friends over and they all stood in a huddle against the rain and the wind. Teresa told the story of how she and Ethan had taken a trip to the peninsula several months after they'd started dating.
They stayed at a B&B in Port Angeles and, late one afternoon, stumbled upon the trailhead to Striped Peak. They reached the summit at sunset on a clear, calm evening, and as she stared across the strait at the long view into southern Canada, Ethan dropped to one knee and proposed. He'd bought a toy ring from a convenience store vending machine that morning. Said he hadn't been planning anything like this, but that he'd realized on this trip that he wanted to spend the rest of his life with her. Told her he'd never been happier than in this moment, standing on the top of this mountain and the world spread out beneath them. "I hadn't been planning anything like it either," Teresa said. "But I said yes, and we stayed up there and watched the sun go into the sea. Ethan and I always talked about coming back here for a weekend, but you know what they say about life and making other plans. Anyway, we had our perfect moments." She kissed the top of her son's head. "And our not-so-perfect ones. But I think Ethan was never happier, never more carefree and hopeful about the future than that sunset on the top of this mountain 13 years ago. As you know, the circumstances surrounding his disappearance," she pushed back against the storm of emotion that was waiting, always waiting. "Well, we don't really have a body or ashes or anything. But," a smile through the tears, "I did bring this." She dug an old plastic ring out of her pocket, the gold paint of the band long since flaked away, the flimsy prongs still holding the emerald-colored prism of glass. Some of the others were crying now, too. "He did eventually get me a diamond, but it seemed appropriate, if not more cost-efficient, to bring this." She pulled a garden spade out of her wet backpack. "I want to leave something close to Ethan here. And this feels right. Ben, would you help me?" Teresa knelt down and swept away the ferns until she saw the ground. It was saturated from the rain, and the spade speared through easily. She dug out several chunks of earth and then let Ben do the same. "I love you, Ethan," she whispered. "And I miss you so much." Then she dropped the ring into the shallow grave and covered it with the upturned earth and leveled it off with the back of the blade. That night, back at their home in Upper Queen Anne, Teresa threw a party. Packed the house with friends, acquaintances, co-workers, loads of booze. Their core group of friends, now responsible, tame professionals, had once upon a time been wild and prone to excess, and on the drive home, they'd all vowed to tie one on in Ethan's honor. They kept their word. They drank like fish. They told stories about Ethan. They laughed and cried. At 10:30, Teresa was standing on their deck that overlooked the small backyard, and on rare, clear days, the Seattle skyline and the hulking, white mass of Mount Rainier to the south. Tonight, the buildings of downtown were obscured in mist, their presence relegated to radiating the cloud deck with a neon glow. She leaned against the railing, smoking a cigarette with Darla, something she hadn't done since her sorority days in college, and nursing her fifth G&T of the night. She hadn't had this much to drink in ages, knew she'd pay for it in the morning, but for now, she reveled in this beautiful padding that protected her from the sharp edges of reality, the unanswered questions, the fear that was always with her, that haunted her dreams. She said to Darla, "What if his life insurance benefit doesn't pay? Why wouldn't it, honey? No proof of death? That's ridiculous. I'll have to sell this house. I can't swing the mortgage on my paralegal salary." She felt Darla's arm slide through hers. "Don't think about that right now. Just know that you have friends who love you, who'd never let anything happen to you or Ben." Teresa set her empty glass on the railing. He wasn't perfect, she said. I know. Not by a long, long shot. But the mistakes he made, when it came down to it, he owned them. I loved him. Always. Even when I first found out, I knew I'd forgive him. He could have done it again, and the truth is, I would have stayed. He had me, you know?
So you two had reconciled completely before he left?
Yeah. I mean, there were still really tough feelings. What he did,
I know.
But we'd come through the worst of it. We were in counseling. We would have made it. And now, I'm a single mother, Dee.
Let's get you to bed, Teresa. It's been a long day. Don't touch anything. I'll come over in the morning, help you clean up.
Almost 15 months he's been gone. And every day I wake up, I still don't believe this is really happening. I keep waiting for my cell to ring, for a text from him. Ben asks me constantly when Daddy's coming home. He knows the answer, but it's the same thing as with me. Same reason I keep checking my phone.
Why, honey?
Because maybe this time it'll show a missed call from Ethan. Because maybe this time when Ben asks me, I'll have a different answer for him. I'll tell him Daddy will be home from his trip next week.
Someone called Teresa's name. She turned carefully, unbalanced by the gin. Parker, one of the young associates at the law firm where she worked, stood in the threshold of the sliding glass door.
There's someone here to see you, Teresa.
Who is it?
Guy named Hassler.
Teresa felt a quiver in her stomach.
Who's that?
Darla asked.
Ethan's boss. Shit, I'm drunk.
Do you want me to tell him you can't?
No, I want to talk to him.
Teresa followed Parker inside. Everyone had hit it too hard, and the party had crashed and burned. Jen, her college roommate from her junior year, had passed out on the couch. Several of her other girlfriends had gathered in the kitchen around someone's iPhone, very drunk and attempting to call a cab on speakerphone. Her sister, Margie, a teetotaler and possibly the only sober adult in the house, grabbed her arm as she passed and whispered that Ben was sleeping peacefully upstairs in his room. Hassler stood waiting in the foyer, in a black suit, black tie loosened, bags under his eyes. She wondered if he'd just come from the office.
"Hi, Adam," she said.
They exchanged a quick hug, quick kiss on the cheek.
"I am sorry I couldn't come earlier," Hassler said. "It's been, well, it's been a day, but I just wanted to drop by for a minute."
"It means a lot. Can I get you a drink?"
"Beer would be great."
Teresa stumbled over to the half-empty keg of Fat Tire and filled a plastic cup. She sat with Adam on the third step of the staircase.
"I apologize," she said. "I'm a little bit drunk. We wanted to send Ethan off like the good old days."
Hassler sipped his beer. He was a year or two older than Ethan, smelled faintly of Old Spice, and still wore that same crew cut he'd had since she first met him at the company Christmas party all those years ago. A trace of red, just a day's growth, was coming in across his jaw. She could feel the bulge of his firearm off the side of his hip.
"Are you still running into problems with Ethan's life insurance?" Hassler asked.
"Yes. They're dragging their feet paying. I think they're going to make me bring a lawsuit."
"If it's all right with you, I'd like to call first thing next week. See if I can throw some weight, move things along."
"I'd really appreciate that, Adam."
She noticed she was speaking slowly and with extreme care in an effort to keep her words from slurring.
"You'll send me the adjuster's contact information?" he asked.
"Yes."
"I want you to know, Teresa, that
It's the first thing on my mind every day, finding out what happened to Ethan, and I will find out.
Do you think he's dead?
A question she would never have asked sober. Hassler was quiet for a while, staring down into the amber-colored beer, said finally,
Ethan was a great agent. Maybe my best. I'm not just saying that.
And you think we'd have heard from him by now, or?
Exactly. I'm sorry.
No, it's...
He handed her a handkerchief, and she cried into it for a moment before wiping her eyes.
Not knowing. It's so hard. I used to pray that he was still alive. Now I just pray for a body. A physical thing to give me answers and let me move on. Can I ask you something, Adam?
Of course.
What do you think happened?
Maybe now isn't the time.
Please.
Hassler finished off the cup of beer. He went over to the keg, refilled it, returned.
Let's just take what we know as a starting point, all right?
Ethan arrived in Boise on a direct flight out of Seattle at 8:30 a.m. on September 24th of last year. He went to the field office downtown in the U.S. Bank building and met up with Agent Stallings and his team. They had a 2.5-hour meeting, and then Ethan and Stallings left Boise at approximately 11:15 a.m.
And they were going to Wayward Pines to look into,
among other things, the disappearance of Agent Bill Evans and Kate Hewson. Just the utterance of her name was like a knife sliding between Teresa's ribs. She suddenly wanted another drink. Hassler went on. You last spoke to Ethan on a cell phone call at 1:20 p.m. from Loman, Idaho, where they'd stopped for gas.
The connection was bad because they were in the mountains.
At this point, they were an hour outside of Wayward Pines.
Last thing he said to me was, I'll call you tonight from the hotel, sweetheart. And I tried to tell him goodbye and that I loved him, but the call dropped.
And yours was the last contact anyone had with your husband. At least, anyone who's still alive.
Of course, you know the rest.
She did, and she didn't need to ever hear it again. At 3:07 p.m., at an intersection in Wayward Pines, Agent Stallings had pulled out in front of a Mack truck. He'd been killed instantly, and because of the violence of the collision and the devastation to the front passenger side, the car had to be taken to another location to extricate Ethan's body. Except, once they'd torn the door off and pried up enough of the roof to get inside, they'd found the compartment empty. The other reason I came by, Teresa, was to share a little bit of news. As you know, we weren't satisfied with the internal examination we had performed on Stallings' Lincoln Town Car.
Right?
So I called in a favor from the FBI's scientific analysis team, CODIS. They do amazing work, the best work, and they just finished spending a week with the car.
And?
I can email you their report tomorrow. But long story short, they didn't find anything.
What do you mean?
I mean they found nothing. No trace of skin cells or blood or hair or even residual sweat. Not even what they call degraded DNA. If Ethan had ridden in that car for 3 hours on the drive from Boise to Wayward Pines, this team would have at least found some molecular trace of him.
How is this possible?
I don't know yet. Teresa grabbed the banister and struggled onto her feet, made her way over to the makeshift bar on the dry sink. Didn't even bother with another G&T. Just scooped some ice into a rocks glass and filled it with premium vodka. She took a long pull, staggered back over to the staircase.
I don't know how to process this, Adam, she said,
and with the next sip, she knew this would be the drink that pushed her firmly over the edge.
I don't either. You asked me what I thought had happened.
Yeah?
I don't have any answers for you. Not yet. Strictly between you and me, we're taking another hard look at Agent Stallings. A hard look at everyone who had access to the scene of the accident prior to my arrival. But so far, we've gotten nowhere. And as you know, this happened over a year ago.
Something isn't right, she said.
Hassler stared at her, his hard eyes troubled.
No shit, he said.
Teresa walked him out to his car and stood on the wet street getting rained on and watching the taillights grow smaller and smaller before disappearing over the top of the hill. All up and down the street, she could see the lights of Christmas trees inside their neighbors' houses. She and Ben hadn't put one up yet, and she doubted they'd get around to it this year. The gesture would feel too much like an acceptance of this nightmare, the final acknowledgement that he was never coming home. Later, after everyone had cabbed home, she lay on the couch downstairs in the aftermath of the party, fighting the spins. She couldn't sleep, couldn't pass out. Every time she opened her eyes, she'd focus on the wall clock as the minute hand trudged between 2 and 3 a.m. At 2:45, unable to stand the nausea and the dizziness for another second, she rolled off the couch, climbed to her feet, and moved unsteadily into the kitchen. She took one of the few remaining clean glasses out of the cabinet and filled it under the tap, drank and refilled two more times before her thirst was quenched. The kitchen was a disaster. She dimmed the track lighting and started loading the dishwasher, something satisfying about watching it fill up. She initiated the wash cycle and then walked around the house with a plastic bag, collecting beer cups, paper plates, discarded napkins. By 4 a.m., the house was looking better, and she didn't feel nearly as drunk, although a pounding had become noticeable behind her eyes, the first indication of the approaching headache. She popped 3 Advil and stood at the kitchen sink in the pre-dawn silence, listening as the rain pattered on the deck outside. She filled the sink with hot water and squirted in the dish soap, watching bubbles begin to populate the surface. Thrust her hands underwater, left them there until the heat became unbearable. She'd been standing in this exact spot that last night when Ethan came home late from work. Hadn't heard the front door close, hadn't heard his footsteps. She'd been scrubbing a skillet when she felt his hands encircle her waist, his breath on the back of her neck. Sorry, T. She keeps scrubbing, says, 7 o'clock? 8? That's late. It's 10:30, Ethan. I don't even know what to call this. How's our little man? Fell asleep in the living room, waiting to show you his trophy. She hates how just the presence of his hands on her body can disarm her anger in a millisecond. She's felt a blinding attraction to him from the first time she spotted him across the bar in Teeny Biggs. Unfair advantage. I have to fly to Boise first thing in the morning, he says into her ear.
His birthday's Saturday, Ethan. He only turns 6 once in his life.
I know, and I hate it, but I have to go.
You know what it's gonna do to him, you not being here? How many times he's going to ask me why you aren't?
I get it, Teresa, all right? You think this hurts you more than it hurts me?
She pushes his hands off her hips and turns around to face him. Asks, does this new assignment have anything to do with trying to find her? I'm not going to do this right now, Teresa. I have to be up in 5 hours to catch my flight. I haven't even packed. He gets halfway out of the kitchen before stopping and turning back around. For a moment, they just hold each other's stare. The breakfast table between them and on it, the plate of cold food that will be the last meal Ethan eats under this roof. You know,
he says. It's over. We've moved on. But you don't act like anything has...
I'm just tired of it, Ethan.
Of what?
You work, and you work, and you work, and what's left for us?
The dregs.
He doesn't respond, but she can see the muscles in his jaw quiver. Even this late at night, after a 15-hour day, he looks amazing, standing under the track lighting in that black suit she never gets tired of seeing him wear. Already, her anger is ebbing. A part of her needing to go to him, to be with him. He has such a hold on her. Some kind of magic in it.
Chapter 5. She comes to him across the kitchen, and he wraps his arms around her, buries his nose in her hair. He does this often, trying as of late to recapture that first encounter smell, some mix of perfume and conditioner and core essence that once made his heart trip over itself. But it's either changed now, been lost, or become such an integral part of him that he can no longer detect the scent which, when he could, always carried him back to those first days. More defining even than her short blonde hair and green eyes, a feeling of newness, a fresh turn, like a sharp October afternoon, and the sky blue and bright, and the Cascades and Olympics holding fresh snow, and the trees in the city just beginning to turn. He embraces her. The sting and the shame of all he's put her through are still raw. He can't say for certain, but he suspects that if she'd done the same to him, he'd already be gone. Marvels at her love for him, her loyalty, so far beyond anything he deserves, it only intensifies the shame.
I'm gonna go look in on him, Ethan whispers.
Okay.
When I come back down, you'll sit with me while I eat?
Of course.
He drapes his coat over the banister, slips out of his black shoes, and pads up the stairs, skipping over the squeaky fifth step. There are no bad floorboards the rest of the way, and soon he's standing in the threshold of the bedroom, easing the door open until a splinter of light has carved through the space between the door and the jamb. For Ben's fifth birthday, they painted the walls to reflect space. Blackness, stars, the swirl of distant galaxies, planets, the occasional deep space satellite or rocket, an astronaut drifting. His son sleeps in a tangle of blankets, a small trophy clutched in his hands, a golden plastic boy kicking a soccer ball. Ethan moves quietly across the floor, dodging stray Legos and Hot Wheels, crouches down beside the bed. His eyes have adjusted to the darkness just well enough to draw out the details of Benjamin's face. Softness, serenity. They're shut, but he has his mother's almond eyes. Ethan's mouth. There is a tactile ache, kneeling here in the dark by the bed of his soon-to-be 6-year-old son in the wake of another day he's missed completely. His boy is the most perfect and beautiful thing he's ever laid eyes on, and he feels, acutely, the inexorable passing of 1,000 moments with this little person who will be a man sooner than he can possibly imagine. He touches Ben's cheek with the back of his hand, leans forward, kisses the boy's forehead, brushes a wisp of hair back behind his ear.
I'm so proud of you, he whispers. You can't even imagine.
Last year, the morning of the day he died in a nursing home, wasted from age and pneumonia, his father asked Ethan in a raspy voice,
You spend time with your son?
Much as I can, he'd answered, but his father had caught the lie in his eyes.
It'll be your loss, Ethan. Day'll come when he's grown and it's too late, that you'd give a kingdom to go back and spend a single hour with your son as a boy. To hold him. Read a book to him. Throw ball with a person in whose eyes you can do no wrong. He doesn't see your failings yet. He looks at you with pure love, and it won't last, so you revel in it while it's here.
Ethan thinks often of that conversation, mostly when he's lying awake in bed at night and everyone else asleep, and his life screaming past at the speed of light, the weight of bills and the future and his prior failings and all these moments he's missing, all the lost joy perched like a boulder on his chest.
Can you hear me? Ethan?
Sometimes he feels like he can't breathe. Sometimes his thoughts come so fast he has to find one perfect memory. Cling to it. A life raft.
Ethan, I want you to grab hold of my voice and let it bring you to the surface of consciousness.
Letting it play over and over until the anxiety recedes and the exhaustion comes and he can finally slip under.
I know it's hard, but you have to try.
Into the only portion of his days that any more affords him peace.
Ethan?
Dreams. His eyes shot open. A light bored down into his face, a small, focused point of bright and blinding blue, a pen light. He blinked, it disappeared, and when he opened his eyes again, a man peered down at him through gold wire-rimmed glasses, less than a foot away from his face. Small black eyes, head shaven, a faint silver beard the only indication of age, his skin otherwise smooth and clear. He smiled, small, perfect white teeth.
You can hear me now, yes?
There was formality in the man's tone, implied politeness. Ethan nodded.
Do you know where you are?
Ethan had to think for a moment. He'd been dreaming of Seattle, of Teresa and Ben.
Let's start with something else. Do you know your name? The man asked.
Ethan Burke.
Very good. And again, do you know where you are, Ethan?
He could feel the answer on the cusp of memory, but there was confusion too. Several realities in competition. In one, he was in Seattle. In another, a hospital. In another, an idyllic mountain town called... There was a hole where its name should be.
Ethan?
Yes.
If I told you that you were in a hospital in Wayward Pines, would that jog anything loose?
It didn't just jog something loose. It brought everything back at once like a hard, sudden hit from a linebacker. The memory of his last 4 days jarred into working order, into a sequence of events he felt confident he could lean on.
Okay, Ethan said. Okay, I do remember.
Everything?
I think so.
What's your last recollection?
It took a moment to retrieve, to brush the cobwebs off the synapses, but he found it.
I had a terrible headache. I was sitting on the sidewalk of Main Street, and I...
You lost consciousness.
Exactly.
Do you still have that headache?
No, it's gone.
My name is Dr. Jenkins.
The man shook Ethan's hand and then took a seat in a chair at Ethan's bedside.
You're what kind of doctor?
Ethan asked.
A psychiatrist. Ethan, I need you to answer a few questions for me, if that's all right. You said some interesting things to Dr. Mitre and his nurse when they first brought you in. Do you know what I'm referring to?
No.
You were talking about a dead body in one of the houses here in town, and that you hadn't been able to get in touch with your family.
I don't recall speaking with the nurse or doctor.
You were delirious at the time. Do you have a history of mental illness, Ethan?
Ethan had been fully reclined in bed. Now he struggled to sit up. Threads of brightness slipped through the drawn blinds. Day out there. On some primal level, he felt glad for the fact.
What kind of question is that? Ethan asked.
The kind I get paid to ask. You showed up here last night with no wallet, no ID.
I was pulled out of a car accident several days ago, and either the sheriff or the EMTs didn't do their fucking job, and now I'm stranded here without a phone, money, or ID. I didn't lose my wallet.
Relax, Ethan. Nobody's saying you've done anything wrong. Again, I need you to answer my questions.
Do you have a history of mental illness?
No.
Is there a history of mental illness in your family?
No.
Do you have a history of post-traumatic stress disorder?
No.
But you did serve in the Second Gulf War.
How'd you know that?
Jenkins motioned to his neck. Ethan glanced down at his chest, saw his dog tag hanging from a ball chain.
Strange. He always kept it in his bedside table drawer. Couldn't remember the last time he'd worn it.
Didn't think he'd brought it along on this trip, and certainly didn't remember packing it or making the decision to wear it. He scanned over his name, rank, social security number, blood type, and religious preference. No religious pref, engraved in the stainless steel. Chief Warrant Officer Ethan Burke.
Ethan?
What?
You served in the Second Gulf War?
Yeah, I flew the UH-60.
What's that?
The Black Hawk helicopter.
You saw combat, I assume?
I did.
Extensive?
You could say that.
Were you injured?
I don't understand what this has to do with any...
Just answer my questions, please.
I was shot down in the Second Battle of Fallujah in the winter of 2004. It was a medevac mission, and we just loaded up some wounded Marines.
Was anyone killed?
Ethan took a deep breath in. Exhaled. If he was honest, the question had surprised him, and now he found himself bracing against a slideshow of images he'd spent a lot of therapy sessions trying to come to terms with. The shockwave as the RPG explodes behind him, the severed tail section and rotor falling 150 feet to the street below, the sudden G-force as the helicopter spins, alarms going mad, the impossible rigidity of the power stick, the impact not nearly as bad as he feared, consciousness lost only for half a minute. Seatbelt jammed, can't reach his K-bar.
Ethan, was anyone killed?
Insurgent fire already tearing into the other side of the wreckage, someone opening up with an AK. Through the cracked windshield, two medics limping away from the chopper. Shell-shocked.
Ethan?
Straight into the four-blade rotor still spinning fast enough. There. Gone. Blood sheeting down the windshield. More gunfire. The insurgents coming.
Ethan?
Everyone was killed except me, Ethan said.
You were the sole survivor?
Correct. I was captured.
Jenkins jotted something on a leather-bound notepad. He said,
I need to ask you a few more questions, Ethan. The more honest you are, the better chance I have at helping you, which is all I want to do. Have you been hearing any voices?
Ethan tried to suppress the glare.
Are you kidding?
If you could just answer,
no.
Jenkins scribbled on his pad.
Have you had any difficulty talking? For instance, maybe your speech has been garbled or mixed up?
No. And I'm not delusional. And I'm not having hallucinations or,
well, you wouldn't really know if you were having hallucinations now, would you?
You'd believe the things you were seeing and hearing were real.
I mean, if you were hallucinating me and being in this hospital room and this entire conversation we're having, it wouldn't feel any different, would it?
Ethan slid his legs over the side of the bed and eased his feet down onto the floor.
What are you doing? Jenkins asked.
Ethan started toward the closet, weak, unstable on his legs.
You're in no condition to be leaving, Ethan. They're still evaluating your MRI. You could have a closed head injury, and we don't know the severity. We need to continue our evaluation.
I'll get an evaluation. Just not here, not in this town.
Ethan pulled open the closet door, took his suit down off the hanger.
You did walk into the sheriff's office without a shirt on, is that correct?
Ethan slid his arms into his white button-down, which appeared to have been washed since he wore it last, the stink of human decay replaced with the scent of laundry detergent.
It reeked, Ethan said. It smelled like the dead man I had just—
You mean the one in the abandoned house that you say you found?
I didn't say I found it. I found it.
And did you go to the residence of Mac and Jane Scozie, whom you'd never met before, and verbally harass Mr. Scozie on his front porch? Is that a fair statement?
Ethan started on the buttons, fingers trembling, struggling to fit them through the holes. Got them out of order, but he didn't care. Get dressed, get out of here, clear of this town.
Walking around with a potential brain injury is not on the list of smart things to do, Jenkins said. He had risen out of his chair.
There's something wrong here, Ethan said.
I know. That's what I've been trying to
know. This town, the people in it, you. Something's off, and if you think I'm going to sit here, let you fuck with me for one more second,
I am not fucking with you, Ethan. No one here is fucking with you. Do you have any idea how paranoid that statement sounds? I'm merely trying to determine if you're in the throes of a psychotic episode.
Well, I'm not. Ethan pulled on his pants, got them buttoned, reached down for his shoes.
Forgive me if I don't take your word on that. An abnormal condition of the mind generally characterized by a loss of contact with reality. That's the textbook definition of psychosis, Ethan. It could have been caused by the car accident, by seeing your partner killed, or some buried trauma from the war resurfacing.
Get out of my room, Ethan said.
Ethan, your life could be—
Ethan looked at Jenkins across the room, and something in his stare, his body language, must have suggested the real threat of violence. Because the psychiatrist's eyes went wide, and for the first time, he shut up.
Nurse Pam looked up from her paperwork behind the desk in the nurse's station.
Mr. Burke, what on earth are you doing up and dressed and out of bed?
Leaving.
Leaving?
She said it like she didn't comprehend the word.
The hospital?
Wayward Pines.
You're in no condition to even be out of—
I need my personal belongings right now. The sheriff told me the EMTs may have removed them from the car.
I thought the sheriff had them.
No.
You sure about that?
Yes.
Well, I can put on my Nancy Drew hat and—
Stop wasting my time. Do you know where they are?
No.
Ethan turned away from her, started walking. Nurse Pam called after him. He stopped at the elevator, punched the down arrow button. She was coming now. He could hear her quick footsteps on the checkered linoleum. Turned and watched her approach in that lovely throwback of a nurse's uniform. She stopped a few feet away. He had 4 or 5 inches on her, a few years as well.
"I can't let you leave, Ethan," she said. "Not until we know what's wrong with you."
The elevator doors screeched open. Ethan backed away from the nurse into the car.
"Thanks for your help and your concern," he said, pressing G 3 times until the button illuminated. "But I think I got it figured out."
"What?"
"It's this town that's wrong."
Pam stretched her foot across the threshold, blocked the doors from closing.
"Ethan, please, you're not thinking clearly.
Move your foot."
"I'm worried about you. Everyone here is."
He'd been leaning back against the wall. Now he pushed off and came forward, stopping inches away from Pam, staring at her through the 4-inch space between the doors. He looked down, tapped the tip of her white shoe with the tip of his black shoe. For a long moment she held her ground, Ethan beginning to wonder if he would have to physically remove her from the elevator. Finally, she pulled her foot back. Standing on the sidewalk, Ethan thought the town seemed quiet for late afternoon. He couldn't hear a single car engine. Nothing, in fact, but the sound of birds cheeping and wind pushing through the crowns of 3 tall pines that loomed over the hospital's front lawn. He walked out into the middle of the street, stood there watching, listening. The sun felt good and warm in his face. The breeze carried a pleasant chill. He looked up at the sky, dark blue crystal. No clouds, flawless. This place was beautiful, no question, but for the first time, those mountain walls that boxed this valley inside instilled something in him other than awe. He couldn't explain why, but they filled him with fear, a dread he couldn't quite put his finger on. He felt strange. Maybe he'd suffered an injury, but maybe not. Maybe being detached from the outside world, now going on 5 days, was beginning to take its toll. No iPhone, no internet, no Facebook. It seemed impossible, as he considered it, to have had no contact with his family, with Hassler, with anyone outside of Wayward Pines. He started walking toward the sheriff's office. Better to just leave, regroup, reevaluate from the other side of those cliff walls, from the comfort of a normal town. Because something here was definitely off-kilter. Sheriff Pope in? Belinda Moran looked up from her game of solitaire.
Hello, she said. How can I help you?
Ethan asked a touch louder this time.
Is the sheriff in? No, he stepped out for a moment.
So he'll be back shortly?
I don't know when he's due back.
But you said, for a moment, so I figured, it's just a figure of speech, young man. Do you remember me? Agent Burke from the Secret Service?
Yes. You have your shirt on this time. I like this look much better.
Have there been any calls for me? She squinted and cocked her head.
Why would there be?
Because I told some people they could reach me here. Belinda shook her head.
No one's called for you,
not my wife, Teresa, or an agent, Adam Hassler.
No one's called for you, Mr. Burke, and you shouldn't tell them to call for you here.
I need to use the telephone in your conference room again.
Belinda frowned. I don't think that's a good idea.
Why? She didn't have an answer to this, just maintained her scowl.
Teresa? It's me. Just trying to reach you. I was in the hospital again. I don't know if you called the sheriff's office or the hotel, but I haven't gotten any messages. I'm still in Wayward Pines. I haven't been able to find my phone or wallet, but I'm done with this place. I'm going to borrow a cruiser from the sheriff's office. Call you tonight from Boise. Miss you. Love you.
He leaned forward in the chair, got a new dial tone, and then shut his eyes and tried to conjure it. The number was there. He spun it out, listened to four rings, and then the same voice from the last time answered.
Secret Service.
This is Ethan Burke calling again for Adam Hassler.
He's not available at the moment. Was there something I could help you with?
Is this Marcy?
Yes.
Do you recall our phone conversation from yesterday?
You know, sir, we get a lot of calls here every day, and I just can't keep up with every...
You told me you'd slip Agent Hassler a message.
What was it regarding?
Ethan closed his eyes, took a deep breath. If he insulted her now, she'd just end the phone call. If he waited until he was back in Seattle, he could publicly eviscerate her, have her fired on the spot. Marcy... It was regarding a dead Secret Service agent in Wayward Pines, Idaho.
Well, if I said I would give him the message, then I'm sure I followed through on that.
But I haven't heard back from him. Don't you find that strange? That an agent from Hassler's field office, me, located another agent who had been murdered, an agent I was sent here to find, and now 24 hours have passed, and Hassler hasn't even returned my call? A slight pause, and then,
"Was there something I could help you with?"
"Yes. I'd like to speak with Agent Hassler right now."
"Oh, I'm sorry. He's not available at the moment. Was there something..."
"Where is he?"
"He's not available."
"Where is he?"
"He's not available at the moment, but I'm sure he'll call you back at his earliest convenience.
He's just been very swamped.
Who are you, Marcy?
Ethan felt the phone rip out of his grasp. Pope slammed it down into the cradle, the sheriff's eyes boring through Ethan like a pair of smoldering coals.
Who told you you could come in here and use my telephone?
No one, I just...
That's right. No one. Get up.
Excuse me?
I said get up. You can either walk out of here under your own steam, or I can drag you through the lobby myself.
Ethan stood up slowly, faced the sheriff across the table.
You're speaking to a federal agent, sir.
I'm not convinced.
What the hell does that mean?
You show up here, no ID, no phone, nothing. I've explained my situation.
Did you take a trip over to 604 First Avenue, see the body of Agent Evans?
I did.
And?
Under investigation.
You've called in crime scene specialists to process the...
It's all being handled.
What does that even mean?
Pope just stared at him, Ethan thinking. He's unhinged, and you have no support in this town.
Just get a car, get out of here.
Hammer him when you come back with the cavalry. He'll lose his badge, face prosecution for hamstringing a federal investigation.
I have a favor to ask, Ethan said, conciliatory.
What?
I'd like to borrow one of your vehicles.
The sheriff laughed.
Why?
Well, obviously, since the accident, I don't have one.
This ain't Hertz Rent-A-Car.
I need some transportation, Arnold.
It's just not possible.
Is this your sheriff's department? You can do whatever you want, right?
The sheriff blinked.
I don't have one to lend you.
Pope started walking down the length of the conference table.
Let's go, Mr. Burke.
Pope stopped at the open door and waited for Ethan. As Ethan drew within range, Pope grabbed his arm and pulled him in close, his large, powerful hand crushing his biceps.
I may have questions for you in the not-too-distant, the sheriff said.
About what?
Pope just smiled.
Don't even think about leaving town.
Walking away from the sheriff's department, Ethan glanced over his shoulder, saw Pope watching him through a split in the conference room blinds. The sun had gone behind the mountains. The town stood silent. He put a block between himself and Pope's office and sat down on the curb of a quiet street.
This isn't right, he whispered, and he kept whispering it.
He felt weak and hungry. Tried to lay everything out, all that had happened since he'd come to Wayward Pines, scrambling to assemble a snapshot of the entire picture, thinking if he could see it all at once, he might piece these bizarre encounters together into a problem to be solved. Or at least, one that made sense. But the harder he tried, the more he felt like he was thinking inside a cloud. An epiphany. Sitting here wasn't going to change a damn thing. He came to his feet, started toward Main Street. Go to the hotel. Maybe there's a message waiting from Teresa or Hassler. False hope. He knew it. There would be no message. Nothing but enmity. I am not losing my mind. I am not losing my mind. He recited his name, his social security number, his physical address in Seattle, Teresa's maiden name, the date of his son's birth. It all felt real, like scraps of information that formed his identity. Comfort in names and numbers. A clinking on the next block caught his attention. There was a vacant lot across the street with several picnic tables, a few grills, and a horseshoe pit. Families had gathered for a party. A group of women stood talking by a pair of red coolers. Two men flipped burgers and hot dogs on a grill, smoke rising in blue coils into the still evening air. The smell of cooking meat made Ethan's stomach ache, and he realized that he was even hungrier than he thought. New goal. Eat. He crossed the street to the chirping of crickets and lawn sprinklers clinking in the distance.
wondered, are they real? Kids chased one another in the grass, shouting, laughing, shrieking. Tag. The clinking was coming from a game of horseshoes. Two groups of men stood across from each other in opposing sand pits, cigar smoke clouding around their heads like exploded halos. Ethan had almost reached the vacant lot, thinking the best move would be to approach the women. Crank the charm. These seemed like decent people living a perfect moment of the American dream. He straightened his jacket as he moved from the pavement into the grass, smoothing the wrinkles, fixing his collar. Five women, one in her early 20s, three between 30 and 40, one silver-haired, mid to late 50s. They were drinking lemonade out of clear plastic cups and discussing some piece of neighborhood gossip. No one had noticed him yet. 10 feet out, while trying to invent some non-intrusive way of breaking into their conversation, a woman his age looked over at him and smiled. "Hello there," she said. She wore a skirt that dropped below her knees, red flats, and a plaid blouse. Her hair was short and vintage, like something from a 50s sitcom. "Hi," Ethan said. "You come to crash our little block party?" "I have to admit, the smell of whatever you've got cooking on that grill pulled me over." "I'm Nancy." She broke away from her group and extended her hand. Ethan shook it. "Ethan, you new here?" she asked. "I just got into town a few days ago." "And how are you enjoying our little hamlet?" "You have a lovely town. Very welcoming and warm." "Aw, maybe we will feed you after all," she laughed. "You live around here?" Ethan asked. "We all live within a few blocks. The neighborhood tries to get together for a cookout at least once a week." "How Mayberry of you." The woman blushed deeply. "So what are you doing in Wayward Pines, Ethan?" she asked. "Just here as a tourist. Must be nice. I can't even remember my last vacation." "When you live in a place like this," Ethan said, gesturing to the surrounding mountains, "why would you ever leave?" "Would you care for a cup of lemonade?" Nancy asked. "It's homemade and delicious." "Sure." She touched his arm. "Be right back. Then I'll introduce you around." As Nancy went to the coolers, Ethan glanced toward the other women, looking for a window to enter the conversation. The oldest of the bunch, a woman with pure white hair, was laughing at something, and as it occurred to him that he'd heard this laugh before, she brushed her shoulder-length hair back behind her ears. The nickel-sized birthmark on her face stopped his heart. It couldn't be, but right height, right build. She was speaking now, the voice almost unquestionably familiar. She drew back from the group of women, pointing at the youngest with a mischievous smirk. "I'm going to hold you to that, Christine," she said. Ethan watched her turn and walk to the farthest horseshoe pit, where she laced her fingers through those of a tall, broad-shouldered man with a mane of wavy silver hair. "Come on, Harold. We're going to miss our show." She tried to pull him away. "One more throw," he protested. She released him, and Ethan stood speechless as Harold lifted a horseshoe out of the sand, took careful aim, and gave it a toss. The horseshoe arced over the grass and ringed the metal stake. Harold's team cheered. He gave several dramatic bows and let the snow-haired woman drag him away from the party. Their friends called good night after them. "Ethan, here's your lemonade," Nancy offered him the cup. "I'm sorry. I have to go." He turned and walked back out into the street. Nancy called after him, "Don't you want to stay and eat?" By the time Ethan turned the corner, the older couple were a block ahead of him. He quickened his pace, followed them for several blocks as they walked slowly ahead at the pace of two people who had not a care in the world, holding hands, their voices and laughter lilting up into the pines. They turned down a street and vanished. Ethan jogged to the next intersection. Quaint Victorian houses lined both sides of the street. He didn't see them anywhere. The sound of a door closing echoed down the block. He spotted the house it had come from, green with white trim, front porch with a swing, third one down on the left.